Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 25th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Walter Bowman, and Walt will be speaking on Introduction to Theology, Paul Tillich. Let's listen in on Walt.
Walter Bowman? No, this is, we gotta roll the tape, whoever is doing it. My name is Walter Bowman, and the title of this session is Introduction to Theology, Paul Tillich. I was used to be embarrassed to announce my name at the beginning of something till I heard the story of the Columbia University professor who had a reputation for remembering the names of all of his former students and what courses they took with him and even where they sat in class. And he saw a former student in an airport in Houston in a ticket line, and he rushed up to her and he said, "You took a course in the history of English literature at Columbia University in the summer of 1965. "That's right, and your name is Janet Larson." "Oh yes," she said, "and you sat next to Ralph Smith." "Oh my goodness," she said, "but who are you?" So I'm Walt Bowman, and Bill's heard this joke before. All right. Well, I'm glad to see so many people back for Tillich. We're gonna have an interesting time, I think. Yesterday we talked about C.S. Lewis, who was, I think, the greatest lay theologian of the 20th century. His theology was not authoritarian in the sense that he didn't rely particularly on authorities, the Bible, for example, or the teaching authority of the church. He was trying to ground his ideas intrinsically, to make a case for them on their own merits. He was concerned with the meaning of theological concepts and used the classical moral argument in order to demonstrate the existence of a supernatural God and to identify Christianity as a struggle between this supernatural God and a supernatural devil, as was evident not only in his great classical writings like the Screwtape Letters, but also in his children's stories and his novels and his other theological writings. I use the word apologete of Lewis, and it's even more true of Paul Tillich. But apologetics is not so much being sorry for what one has done, as in the word apology, but apologetics means a defense, a making a case for, a defense of something. And in fact, it's almost the essence of systematic theology. I put on the board above you the two greatest Protestant theological figures of the 20th century. We could add one more to that. The greatest Catholic theologian of the 20th century would be Karl Rahner, R-A-H-N-E-R, Jesuit theologian from Austria, one of whose students, Cardinal Ratzinger, is now the sort of defender of the faith in Rome, head of the Holy Office, or the Congregation of the Faith. I think that's what it's called now. But if we think of the two great Protestant theologians of this century, they would have to be Karl Barth and Paul Tillich. It's no accident that Karl Barth called his great theological work the Church Dogmatics. The Church Dogmatics. Barth thought that theology was the great sellout. Systematic theology was the great sellout. And he did not want to be known as a systematic theologian. He wanted to be known as a dogmatic theologian, that is, as one whose sole function is to interpret the dogmatic teachings of the church. He believed that that systematic theology, with its attempt to find points of contact between the Word of God and the way in which we understand our world, that was already tainted and betraying the direct address of God. Barth said God addresses us senkrecht vom oben, that is, perpendicularly from heaven above down to us, with no preparation, no, the Germans have wonderful words for this, no Anknüpfungspunkt, no point that sort of attaches itself to anything that we are. Anknüpfen is what you do when you button something. In order to have a button, you got to have a hole on one side and a button on the other. And then you can knüpf it, you can put it together, you see. Now, that's classic apologetics. There is stuff going on in us with which God connects, and it is the task of the theologian to bring them together. See the buttonhole and the button. Barth didn't want any buttonholes. He wanted lightning to strike us, you know, from the top, nothing going on before that. Barth's great opponent was Schleiermacher, Friedrich Schleiermacher, whose first great book in Berlin in 1799 was The Speeches on Religion to the Cultured Among Its Despisers. He was trying to communicate the meaning of Christianity to the cultured population of Berlin and probably the world. And so he wrote his great Glaubenslehre, his great theology of the faith of the church, as a way of trying to find a point of contact. And so he started with the pious self-consciousness and tried to develop all religious ideas out of that. Barth said an emphatic no to all of that and did exactly the opposite. He tried to turn Schleiermacher on his head, 180 degrees, and so his book was not a systematic theology, it was a dogmatics. Tillich, on the other hand, was very much the apologete and expressly entitled his great work Systematic Theology, because systematic theology asks questions like the meaning and the grounding. What grounds do we have for saying anything at all? And how does it all fit together? Barth is not interested in any of these questions. And the consequence, as Langdon Gilkey once pointed out, is that while Barth or Barthian type theology could be very forceful, in the end it really left you wondering whether it had any connection at all with how we live or what we think or who we are. I have to do a little bit of my own biographical history here. In 1952 I went to New York City. I was an intern in New York City, and part of the internships gave me a day to go to Union Seminary. So every Monday, I went down to Union Theological Seminary in New York, and I took a course with Tillich, two courses, as a matter of fact. He was giving lectures in the morning on the history of Christian thought, and in the afternoon, he was doing a seminar on Luther, and then in the spring term, on Calvin. So I went regularly every morning to study with Tillich, but I didn't understand him. His vocabulary was so strange, so different, and I wasn't able to get a hold of that vocabulary. In 1954, when I was a Fulbright student in Germany, I made the pilgrimage to Basel, to Switzerland, because it was only a couple of hours away, and I spent 2 weeks in Basel listening to Karl Barth's lectures. They were mesmerizing. It was wonderful. He lectured every afternoon at 4 o'clock to a packed room full of students, and his language was biblical and traditional. And for a long time, I was a Barthian. I would preach these kind of, you may think such and such, but God says, you know. These was very satisfying. But I always kept wondering when I was done, you know, whether it had anything to do with anything. And I finally concluded it didn't. And so then I rediscovered Paul Tillich. And I discovered that Tillich, despite his strange language, was very, very Lutheran in his construct, in his thinking, in everything. So, a brief look at his... I should add, by the way, that both Barth and Tillich were fired by the Nazis from their positions and ordered out of the country. So, I mean, and Tillich was one of Barth's great critics and opponents, and both of them suffered in their own way for the way they were doing Christian theology. Tillich was first to feel the axe in March of 1933, within weeks after Hitler took power, and Barth came a little later, after the great Barman conference protesting Nazism, the Confession of Barman. Barth too was ordered out of the country. For Tillich, it was much more traumatic than it was for Barth. And I want to say a little bit about that, because Barth went back home. He was Swiss, and his father had been a professor at Basel. But Tillich was exiled, you see. So Barth goes home, Tillich has to go into exile. And he worried all his life about that. Tillich was born... Tillich's biography, by the way, has been done beautifully by Wilhelm and Marion Pauk. Paul Tillich, His Life and Thought. I think Pauk only finished the first volume, His Life, before he died, and Marion is, I think, working on the second volume, Tillich's Thought. Both were born in the year 1886. Barth to a professorial family in Basel, Tillich to a pastor's family in Prussia. Tillich did his education like Barth did, studying with the great figures of late 19th and early 20th century liberalism, primarily Johann Hermann, who taught at Marburg, and Adolf von Harnack, who taught at Berlin. But Tillich was then involved in the First World War. He was a chaplain. It's hard for us, I think, today to imagine how dreadful that war was for Europeans. The British called it the Great Mincing Machine, and you could measure your life expectancy in terms of your rank. Privates would last 3 weeks in the trenches. A lower non-commissioned officer maybe a couple of months. The generals, of course, lived forever because Sir Alexander Haig, who was the British commander, never went near the front because he did not want his command decisions to be influenced by the carnage he would have seen there. But you see, they were still fighting 19th century battles with 20th century weapons, and they were dying by the thousands every day with every charge for a few hundred square yards of territory. French regiments revolted and wouldn't fight, wouldn't charge. And first they just took all the officers and shot them. And then they took a company out of each battalion and shot it. And then they would shoot them all, you know, to get the men back into the trenches again. To do this terrible stuff, one has to see something like Farewell to Arms, Hemingway's Farewell to Arms, where the Italian, same thing, as the Italian troops were retreating, they would just single the officers out of the retreat and just shoot them to get them back into fighting these insane battles. Tillich, as a chaplain, had the task of sending the death notices home to the families and burying the bodies. and he had a nervous breakdown in 1916. Just went bonkers. Was in a rest home and psychological treatment. And then sent back, you see. Catch 22. The people who don't want to fight, you know, are the only sane ones. Oh, well. You know, one must read about all of this and the bitterness of Siegfried Sassoon's statement about the chaplain who said to the troops, "God go with you to the God go with you to the trenches. I shall go with you as far as the station." Well, anyway, Tillich went into the trenches and there had a nervous breakdown. When he came back in 1918 to Berlin, his wife divorced him. And he was living now in the Berlin of Cabaret. If you've seen the movie Cabaret, then you know something of what that was like. A kind of end of the world. Am 30. Mai wird der Welt zu Ende kommen. On the 30th of May, the world will come to the end. And what we are, all we are going to do is party now until then. Is it Christopher Isherwood who did the play "I Am a Camera" out of that same period with a kind of devil may care life, bohemian to the core? Berlin was the center of this kind of despair. Hemingway and the Lost Generation went to Paris, but Tillich and his colleagues in Berlin. In the midst of all of this, however, he managed to get a professorship and to teach. I listed the places in Germany where he taught: Berlin, Marburg, Leipzig, Dresden, and finally Frankfurt. And what he was teaching was the sociology of religion. And in Berlin, he was caught up in religious socialism, which captured his attention and his loyalties and his political interests. But it also attracted the notice of the Nazis. The very word Nazi comes from the first four letters of the name of Hitler's party, Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, National Socialist German Workers' Party. Hitler's appeal was to the discontented and the disinherited by the economic calamities of Germany, by all the people who felt themselves betrayed by the peace and the defeat of World War I. And as soon as Hitler got power, Tillich was out. March of 1933, 47 years old, he had married again in Berlin a woman named Hannah, with whom he had three children. And it was not only out of his professorship, it was out of the country, which meant for Tillich loss of his pension, loss of all his social benefits. Germany, since Bismarck, had been one of the most highly socialized countries of the world. All of this is gone. Reinhold Niebuhr invited him to New York and got him a position in the philosophy department of Columbia University for 1 year. The philosophers didn't want him. They didn't understand him. Tillich is learning a new language. One must think of this. 47 years old, he must learn a new language, and not only to do business, but to do his business, to teach, to think in, you see. And that he succeeded in becoming the outstanding theological philosopher of the United States is simply beyond belief. Well, then they brought him over to Union Seminary across the street from Columbia with great fear and trepidation. One must imagine, you know, Union Seminary is a liberal seminary, but even liberal seminaries in America in the 1930s were relatively conservative, and the president of Union was very worried about his constituency. What was he going to tell them? What was he going to make of this strange figure from Germany who talked this strange language of theology? But Tillich came to Union, and Union committed itself to him, and he stayed there until 1954 to 1955. It's a remarkable period. It was during that time, near the end of it, that I came, 1952-53, to study with him. Here he began to publish his greatest works. He had a remarkable career in this country. When he retired from Union in 1955, Harvard named him university professor, and he taught there for 7 years, from 55 to 62, and then Chicago Divinity School made him John Nuveen professor, and he finally came to Chicago. I met him once more at a cocktail party at the Priory Press. Thomas O'Meara published a book of his, and I was invited to attend the little party that they had for Tillich as they announced the publication. And he sat in the corner in his big chair, shaking hands with everybody, remembering people. These are pictures of Tillich. I think I'm just going to pass these books around so you can see what he looked like. He's a marvelous figure of a man, big and shock of white hair. And one of the great characteristics of this man is that no question was ever too dumb. He would take the stupidest question and say, "Ah, that is very profound," and then he would proceed to unpack it. And the students would just sit there and beam that they had thought of all this profound stuff, you know, in the question. But he just had a wonderful way of making everybody think that they... No, it was not making people think. Tillich was able to understand that there is no dumb question. That's the point. So it wasn't a con job at all. It was simply saying, do you understand what you've asked? Let me try to tell you what you have asked. See how important this is. And students say, oh my goodness, you know. I mean, that's a wonderful gift. That is a great teacher's gift. He learned to use the English language, and he always had assistants, of course, who would take his manuscripts and try to English them a little bit, as he would say. But his speaking was always just thick with German accents. He never did get the TH, that is the question, he would always say, and of course V and W was always confused, because in German it's the opposite of what it is in English. But nevertheless, it was wonderful to study with him. He was ill only a few days, 10 days, I think, in October of 1965, and died of heart disease at age 79. Reconciled with his wife, he said to her, the morning of his death, today is dying day. Remarkable. Business and said some farewells and goodbyes and lay down in his bed and died in the late afternoon of that day. His body was cremated, his ashes were scattered in Indiana in a peace park, and there was a great memorial service for him in Chicago and all over. Late in life, he went back to Germany. He had honors there, finally, in a country that had rejected or kicked him out in 1933. He met Karl Barth. He had a reconciliation with one of his bitterest opponents, Emanuel Hirsch, who was a dedicated Nazi theologian, and who now, living in utter poverty in Germany, Tillich went to see him and brought him some coffee and some chocolate. The scenes of those kinds of reconciliations are a tribute to this remarkable man. Well, his ideas, that's the main thing. I'm sorry to go on so long, but the biographies of these people are so wonderful so instructive. Well, ideas. I want to do something about Tillich's method. Tillich, as a theologian, used a method that he called a method of correlation. And this, by that he meant the correlation of philosophy and theology, or of, to put it another way, the correlation of question and answer. And he developed his whole systematic theology along five such great correlations. I think they're worth putting on the board for us here. So, question, answer. The five correlates are reason and revelation. Being, the question of being and God. The question of existence, and I'm going to put another word under here, alienation. And Christ, the question of life, and I'm going to put another word under, which is community, and the Spirit, and the question of history. Let's add meaning here. I should put under being death, and under reason knowing, and then history and the kingdom of God. Now, what Tillich meant by question is not what questions do we bring to something. You see, what I could ask anything, but what Tillich meant is how in each of these areas we are called into question, so that we are shaken to the depths of our being by the question implied in death, for example, to which the answer, the Christian answer, is God. Or in existence, he says, our existence is basically alienated existence between the ideal, what we know we ought to be and could be and should be, and what we actually are. He says that's the meaning of the fall. We are all fallen from our ideal, and we all know this in our heart of hearts, that we are not what we ought to be. And the answer is the new being, or the Christ, the new being. And the brokenness of our communities that shatter our expectations of life and our hopes, to which the answer is the Spirit of God. And history, the meaninglessness of it all. Not just one damn thing after another, but the same damn thing over and over, as Edna Vincent Millay said. To which the answer is that the thread of meaning is the kingdom of God, you see. I mean, now, this is so Lutheran. How is it Lutheran? We sit here and we say, what does this have to do with Lutheranism? The Lutheran categories with which Tillich is working here are called law and gospel, you see. Because law is not what we ought to do, it is the way in which we are called into question. The meaningfulness, the morality, the wholeness of our existence is called into question. That is what law means in Lutheran terms. And the gospel is always God's addressing of that. But Tillich felt that these categories, law and gospel, that it was the function of philosophy to uncover the questions in our existence, in our life, in our being. And it was the function of theology to address them. That's what Tillich was trying to do. And the one thing about Tillich is that that people listened, people heard him, people went to hear Tillich preach who would never have darkened the door of a church. Barth often preached in jail where the prisoners didn't have any choice, you know, best thing they could do on Sunday. Tillich preached at James Chapel and Madison Avenue, where people had lots of choices. New York is nothing if not a city of massive choices. But people went to hear him because something was being said there. He gives that as a reason. Listen to this. There is a more important reason why I publish these sermons. This is called the Shaking of the Foundations. A large part of the congregation at the Sunday services at which I preached came from outside of the Christian circle in the most radical sense of, for them, a sermon in traditional biblical terms would have had no meaning. Therefore, I was obliged to seek a language which expresses in other terms the human experience to which the biblical and ecclesiastical terminology point. In this situation, an apologetic type sermon has been developed. And since I believe that this is generally the situation in which the Christian message has to be pronounced today, I hope that the publication of some attempts to meet this situation may not be useless. Well, of course they're not useless. These books are still in print 30 years after his death. You can buy them in the bookstore. That's why I brought them along today, to hold them up, all right? The purpose of these lectures is to sell books. Now, well, we might as well be up front. I want to pick out four great ideas from Tillich's book, The Dynamics of Faith, which he published in 1957, about the same time that he was also doing his systematic theology. How many of you have had the dynamics of faith in a college religion class? Anybody here? Some, at least, yes. Wonderful book, absolutely wonderful, and Lutheran to the core, as I'm going to try to show. Four ideas out of that. The first is a non-religious understanding of faith. Kant gave us a religious understanding of faith. I don't know that Kant intended that. Immanuel Kant, the guy who died in 1802. But that was the consequence. Kant said, we know only that which has sense content. So authentic knowing or pure knowing always has a sense component, something you can see, touch, feel, taste, smell. It has a sensory component. But the great categories of religion, Kant says, do not. God, the soul, immortality have no sensory content at all. Yet, said Kant, we need them to behave. We need a God to judge our behavior as good or evil. We need a soul to live forever so that the inequities of this life can be evened out with rewards and punishments appropriately applied once you're dead. But since we need these, but have no way of knowing them, what happens? They become postulates of faith, do you see? So we have to believe there is a God. We have to believe that we have a soul. We have to believe in immortality, right? Now, this immediately begins to divide the world, do you see? Into the religious and the non-religious. The believers and the non-believers, the pious and the impious, and go right down the line. Kant is the one who gave us this. I'm always very uneasy then when people start talking about communities of faith. I want to keep asking, what do you mean, my bank? You know, because the bank is a community of faith too. What we have done is to back off. We say, well, there's the learning community, that's the university, and then there's those of other believers. We're the community of faith. Quatsch, nonsense, Tillich would say. Tillich just shatters all of this by saying, faith means quite simply not asserting some things with an inferior basis in the real world. God, the soul, and immortality. Faith means having an ultimate concern. That is, whatever choices outweigh all the others, see, whatever in my life is more important than anything else, that's my ultimate concern. And that is the object of my believing, of my trusting, of the reason I get up out of bed in the morning, you see. Whatever I will do at all costs, whatever I will protect at all costs, whatever I will hang on to in order to survive at all costs, you see, that is one's ultimate concern. And it is revealed in crunch situations. See, most of us can go through our lives without ever having insight into what our truly ultimate concerns are, because we're able to manage many things at one time. Langdon Gilkey said this in Shantung Compound, that it was in a period where people had only enough space, you see, to lie down and sleep, that they fought over every inch. I've got 5 beds in my house in Columbus. So 4 of you could come and visit me. Wouldn't bother me at all. Be glad to share at least one of those 4 beds with you. Not the 5th, however. 5 people show up and the ball game's over. You know, 2 of you are going to sleep together. It's only the crunch situation that discloses, you see, what I'm willing to live and die for. In George Orwell's 1984, this novel, the main character, forgotten his name now, falls in love with Julia, and the party, of course, can't have this, it's love business, so they get him into the Ministry of Truth, finally. They discover that he hates rats above all, and they get him into the Ministry of Truth, strapped into a chair next to Julia, and they lower toward him a cage of rats, and he sees them ready to leap at him, and there's only this slim little door separating him from the rats, and as the cage gets closer and closer, he strains at the straps and he can't get out, and finally, with the rats inches away, he yells, "Do it to Julia!" And then he knows that they have him. He's broken. He will save himself at her expense. They don't have to do anything to him then. They have him, you see. His ultimate concern to save himself from rats at all costs is revealed to him in the crunch situation. Well, that's Tillich. And now the meaning of God. So the meaning of faith is having an ultimate concern, and the meaning of God is whatever is my ultimate concern. God means whatever concerns me ultimately. This is very Lutheran. In the Large Catechism, Luther begins by asking not does God exist, but what does it mean to have a God? Was heißt es, ein Gott zu haben, says Luther. It's a wonderful question. It is the greatest question in the history of thought about God. What does it mean to have a God? And then Luther goes on, a God is that to which I look for all good in time of need and to which I flee for refuge, you see. Whatever I hang my heart on, Luther says, that's my God. It's a marvelous question. But it is God with a small g, and that is the third point here. God with a small g, because not everything that I make ultimate has, as Paul Tillich puts it, the capacity to bear the weight of ultimacy. We attach ourselves to things that are not in themselves ultimate, but we give them ultimate significance. And we are the ones who must then defend the gods we create. They cannot defend us. They are not gods. The Elijah story comes back again, remember? They are not gods, and therefore they cannot be for us what we have made of them. And it is Tillich's astonishingly powerful insight that we then become destructive in defense of our gods. See, I think about the Missouri Synod Wars, where people did terrible things to each other in the name of defending the Bible, not realizing that they had made of the Bible a god for themselves, which they then had to defend. And to defend by doing terrible things to other people in the church. Tillich points out in this book that the closer we come to truly important things, the more easily they can become idolatrous. Our family, for example, or our nation. See, the most terrible things to see during the whole Vietnam protests were these bumper stickers, America, love it or leave it. Mm-hmm. Which was, if you aren't behind Johnson's war policies in Vietnam, get out of the country. You are not a true American. I read the same kind of stuff. Some of my students tried to play a joke on me by registering me on the mailing lists of the Republican Party. had a student who took me to lunch once and said, Professor Bowman, I have this very serious question to ask of you. He said, I think I'm one of three Republicans in the seminary. And I glared at him and said, who are the other two, you know? he wasn't telling. Anyway, he said, can you be a Republican and a Christian? And I said, with great difficulty, but we worked it through. So anyway, they put me on these mailing lists. I suddenly started getting fundraising letters, you know. And I read them, and they were just absolutely appalling. The Democrats were treasonous, the party of traitors, the party selling out America, you see. I mean, wasn't our opponents, like in British parliamentary politics. And I thought to myself, this is what happens. I was joking about the Republican stuff, but not much. But what I care about is that at least we begin to recognize that there's room for some argument here, and that we ought to treat each other as people who are willing to argue over important things, and not that anybody who disagrees is a traitor. When that happens, you see, then we have elevated the country or the party or our position to the level of ultimacy, which it cannot bear, and we become then its defenders at whatever cost to the other, you see. Well, Tillich's great insight is that this reveals the inauthenticity, the falseness of our gods, you see, that they have to be defended at all costs. And the final great point, and the most difficult, is that God is not supernatural for Tillich. He is, in a sense, the great enemy of all supernaturalism. We have to think of this in terms of the contrast with Lewis. Lewis uses the moral argument, right and wrong as a clue to meaning in the universe, as a way of trying to demonstrate that God is in fact supernatural, and that the way the supernatural interacts with the natural world is through miracle. So Lewis, one of Lewis's most significant books for him was the book entitled Miracles. And he defends miracles, the intervention of the supernatural in the natural world, on the basis of what he calls the greatest of all miracles, namely the incarnation, you see. In this sense, Lewis is a typical Anglican. He doesn't know it. But for Anglicans, Christmas is the great festival, the incarnation. Just for Lutherans, Good Friday is the great church holiday. Well, holiday is too much. The only day Lutherans go to church is Good Friday, see. And for the early church, it was Easter. Neither Christmas nor Good Friday, which is more where Tillich is. This is again very significant. So Lewis defends a supernatural God whose intervention in the natural world is in the miraculous in general, and in the super miracle, the incarnation of Jesus. That is, that this supernatural being becomes natural. And it's a miracle because it's a logical impossibility. The infinite becomes finite. See, the immortal becomes mortal. The supernatural becomes natural. Tillich says, on the other hand, that when you are making God a supernatural being, you are very much in danger of idolatry, Because God is not a being, even that which is different from all other beings. God is in fact, and now here Tillich uses some language that has become sort of special to him, God is being itself, or the ground of all being. These are the same concepts for Tillich. And of course there's the joke that Billy Graham once heard Tillich lecture and then went out and said, the ground of all being, bless you real good, or something like that. But what Tillich means by this is that God is that in which everything that is participates. He doesn't want to say God is in everything, in this rock, this sand, me, the building, the world, the trees, the mountains. He says all of these things are in God. That's the way we need to think, that everything that is participates in being itself. God is the ground of all being. And what does he do then with the Christ? Well, the Christ, he says, is the one who sacrifices himself in order that the new being can come into being as a way which overcomes alienation, all alienation. And we are able to participate in the Christ to the extent that we too are able to, in a sense, well, Tillich's phrase is to sacrifice ourselves, but to die to ourselves, if you will, and to receive a new way of being in the world. That's what it means to participate in the Christ. The Christ, he says, is a symbol, but for Tillich, again, the language is just wonderful, a symbol participates in the very reality in which it symbolizes. So Christ participates in the reality of the being of God, but also participates in our being made capable of dying and becoming something new, becoming something different. He says the sacraments are symbols in that sense too, that they participate in the very realities in which they symbolize. They let us in on something. A sign is arbitrary. It points to something. A symbol is not arbitrary. It belongs essentially to what it symbolizes. Tillich has, therefore, I think, wonderful ways of connecting people who don't, let me put it this way. He has a very good way of making sure that the conversion which is asked of people is not conversion to a set of ideas, but a conversion that involves us in the very depth of our being, that the alienation and the falseness of our lives is overcome and something new can grow out of it. He does not ask people to learn to subscribe to a worldview when they become Christians, but to be transformed in their being. In many ways, that's Lewis's goal too, and I think that's what Lewis and Tillich have in common. And if you want an introduction to Tillich, I think the best place to go are to his sermon books. I passed two of them around, and the third one, The Shaking of the Foundation. These are wonderful, wonderful books, and still communicate powerfully to us today to give meaning to life itself and not just to Christianity. I'm going to stop there and let you fire away with anything you want to talk about. Matthew.
Yeah, well, I was just, as you were talking about God being the basis of all being, how is that, it was beginning to sound like, you know, God is everything, you know, everything is God.
Ah.
Was he saying something like that?
No.
Or can you distinguish?
No, exactly not. He was, that's why I said he is not saying God is in everything or even God is everything, but that everything is in God. All that is grounded in God. And therefore, the connections for Tillich between the world and God, between theology and philosophy, between our being questioned and God's address of us, all of that is possible because we are already, in some sense, by our being, grounded in being itself. Tillich is, in that sense, a classic ontologist. That is one who thinks that being is the primary category of all thinking. And that the idea of being is not just an idea, that it is a reality, and we are in that reality. We are rooted in that reality and participate in it. Yes, Tom.
You had the great fortune of listening to his lectures. As I recall some ancient readings that I was doing with Philip, do you recall any reference he made to exactly that kind of connection between being and the here and now in terms of a reflection on Plato, the notion that the Platonic notion of reality and being was that we all existed in being, as Philip would say. And the sense of God was the sense of wanting to gain that perfection, the same way Plato would define a triangle, that there's no such thing as a perfect triangle except in being, in true being. That every time we try to sort of draw a triangle, as perfect as it may be to our eye, there's always some imperfection. And it is precisely that difference between the natural impossibility of being perfect and the supernatural, which gives us the notion of perfection, that discusses the relationship between us and God. Was that raised at all in any...
Yes, yes, of course. With some, I think, really significant distinctions. Tillich has more in common with the Platonic philosophical tradition than he does with the Aristotelian philosophical tradition, and he acknowledged that. But Plato was still a supernaturalist, and so that God is outside of the natural world. Tillich was not. I mean, he was emphatically not that. And that's what distinguishes him from Plato. He does say that our experience of ourselves is an experience of alienation from the ideal. But he doesn't address that in the first volume of his Systematics. He addresses it in the second volume, where he's trying to talk about sin. For him, sin means alienation of the ideal the alienation of the real from the ideal. And therefore, something has to happen to the real. The real must die in order that the new being can come into existence. And when he gets into the third volume, then the direction of history is towards that ideal, which is the symbol of the kingdom of God. But the kingdom of God is only realized in part here. It is not realized perfectly here. Now, all of these things, of course, have potential affinities with Plato. But at the very start, Tillich would say, I'm not trying to defend an out of this world sense of perfection. God's being is more that which is indestructible, that life has priority over death, and that life is the true reality, or being is the true reality, and we participate in it. I don't know if these, does that make any sense? Okay. Yes.
Did you say that Tillich defined despair as the experience of non-being?
Yes.
That would be a good way to define despair. And so, in a sense, we can never truly despair because we can never not be.
Yes. Yes, this is, oh, I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is one of the really great things. Tillich incorporates doubt and despair into the very structure of his thinking, so that he would say, doubt is not bad. Doubt is a sign, in fact, that faith is there. It is the other side of faith. And because we are grasped by the being of God, encompassed in the being of God, our doubt is taken up into our faith, in fact. And our despair is taken up into our affirmation, our capacity to be affirmed. But yes, despair is the encounter with the possibility of my non-being, and it is overcome by the being of God. It is, in fact, the question that calls us into question in the correlation between being and God.
It doesn't even go in the courage to be. He goes further. He says doubt is necessary.
Yes. Yeah, it isn't just that he can live with it. It belongs, I have that right here, it belongs essentially to what it means to be able to be grasped by the affirmation. Yeah. Oh, please.
Just before you introduce the four points, you said that one of the things that distinguishes Tillich was that he sought a new language, in my own words now, to capture the spirit of the times. So it may not be surprising that someone who witnessed Nazi Germany warns us that not everything that we give ultimate meaning to can bear the weight of ultimacy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, his biography was helpful to understand some of these ideas. The question I'm getting to is, where would you look to for additional salient points to coaches to be effective leaders in this decade? Yeah, are there problems that we're facing? Are there issues that we're facing that Tillich doesn't address because of his autobiographical reference?
Stay around. That's the greatest segue into what I'm going to do the rest of the week. On Thursday, what I want to do is to take up Bonhoeffer. Because Bonhoeffer, too, comes out of that dreadful period, and Bonhoeffer, too, has been in America and has some important things to say about America. Bonhoeffer's theology is quite explicitly Christological, as Tillich's is not. Mm-hmm. Tillich is trying to get what I would call a secularized and traumatized by war age once again to take seriously language about God and language of the tradition that is no longer intelligible. Bonhoeffer is saying that in the midst of suffering, intense suffering, because you see he stays in Germany, or goes back to Germany actually in 1931, in the midst of that suffering, the suffering Christ is a comfort, support, hope, whatever. And that's what we have to talk about on Thursday. And then what I want to do on Friday is to take up a significant post neo-Orthodox generation thinkers, some American, some European, who are addressing a different set of questions. And I want to look at what it means to start theology with the resurrection of Jesus instead of, let's say, with Tillich's questions or C.S. Lewis's moral proof or Bonhoeffer.